You're listening to Sideshow Network.
Hey, everybody. It's Adam Ray and Brad Williams for the About Last Night podcast. Hey, Brad, I got a question for you. Do you shave?
Well, of course I do, Adam. I'm a man.
Me too. I'm a Russian Jew, and I've been shaving since I was 12. And recently, I've been trying to find the best quality and most amazing and affordable shave. Well, I found it. DollarShaveClub.com is the answer. And to prove how amazing their shave really is, right now, they're going to give you, that's right, you, your first month free when you join the club. But don't take my word for it. Listen to Michael Caine.
Hey, listen, everyone. DollarShaveClub.com delivers amazing razors right to my front door for a third of the price. Wait.
I can't do it in the Michael Caine accent. For a third of the price of what the greedy razor corporations charge you.
Hey, it's Tony Danza. And look, I also have no reason to deal with the drugstore hassle and battle the locked up razor fortress ever again. And neither will you when you join the Dollar Shave Club. All you gotta do, go to DollarShaveClub.com and pick a razor that works for you from their lineup of amazing blades. That's all there is to it. What about you, Jason Statham?
Well, I get a first-class shave whenever I use the Executive Blade. And when I use it, along with the Dr. Carver's Easy Shave Butter, the blade just gently glides for the smoothest shave ever.
Look, it's awesome, it's easy, and with Dollar Shave Club, you can look, smell, and shave like $1 million without paying for it.
And ladies, this is not just for guys. Dollar Shave Club is also for women. We know you shave too. You gotta shave your legs, your arms, maybe your mustache. Listen, we're not judging.
Not judging,
not
Grandma.
Judging.
Not
we're
judging.
We're glad you do it.
Shave it. We're glad you do it. Here's your chance to see why over 3 million members like me, Brad, Jason Statham, Michael Caine, Grandma with the mustache, all love Dollar Shave Club. It's so easy too, and they're so confident in the quality of all their products. Now you can get your first month of the club for free. For free. All you gotta do is pay shipping. And after that, it's just a few bucks a month. Just a couple of bucks. No long-term commitment. No hidden fees. There's really no reason not to do it. Can you think of a reason?
Nope.
That's right. There's no reason. That's why I said you can't think of one. Get yours at DollarShaveClub.com/lastnight to get your first month for free. That's DollarShaveClub.com/lastnight. And start living the smooth life, baby. And now enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Hey, everybody. It's Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. How are you? Good to see you. Good to feel you. Good to feel your listening, your attentiveness. Brand new episode today. Hope you had a great weekend. I had a crazy weekend. Holy shit. First of all, midweek on my way to... on my way to Erie, Pennsylvania, which thank you, Junior's Last Laugh, for a great weekend of shows. First time there. So fun. Can't wait to go back. On my way there, my flight got canceled, and I spent Wednesday night in Chicago, because that's where I had a layover. And that just also happened to be the night that the Cubs won the World Series. So I got a hotel about 20 minutes from Wrigleyville, which is where Wrigley Field is and where all the Cub chaos after post-game shit goes down. And I went to a local bar and watched the game, which was unreal. I'm sure you watched it. Everybody did. It was a nice break from all the election bullshit. And then went into the streets until about 5 a.m. and partied like it was 1999. Holy shit. Partying with a team that just won the World Series is incredible. I've never done it. Hopefully my Mariners get to do it one day. But especially with the stakes as high as they were for the Cubbies and the energy and the emotions. I mean, I've posted videos on my Facebook and Instagram of just the streets and the high-fiving and the cars and the chaos and the drinking. And it was sports bring together people like nothing else. And it was like unreal to see the hugs and the high fives and the crying and the conversations and, you know, It was incredible, and I'm so I feel grateful that I was able to like witness that and be a part of it. And you know, Cubbies fans, nobody looked that I was wearing a Mariners hat. They welcomed me into the celebration. So, congrats to the Cubs and all my Chicago friends. That was bonkers. Today's episode is a guest that I just never thought we would get a chance to chat with, but Brad met him at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, struck up a conversation, and look at that, booked him on the podcast. He directed movies such as Rush Hour, X-Men Last Stand, The Family Man, Tower Heist, which brought Eddie Murphy back to the big screen. He's one of the hottest, most successful directors in Hollywood. He's produced so much shit. Just check up his IMDb. His conversation today was not only incredible, he's a guy that can just chat forever, but his stories and his journey into the business is one that it's for sure only happened to him. And he's a go-getter, and he's changed the game, and he was so candid with us, and it was a great conversation. And I'm talking about the one and only Brett Ratner. Brett Ratner, holy shit. He forced his way into NYU film school at age 16. That story will blow your mind and inspire the fuck out of you. This guy does not take no for an answer. It's really puts the whole don't ask, you don't get, attitude to the fullest. How he brought Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker together, how he found Chris Tucker for Rush Hour is an astounding story. He was best friends with Michael Jackson. He's got some great stories there. Directing Nick Cage in The Family Man, how he got Nick Cage attached to the project because he didn't want to do it. It's an hour and change of just story after story, insight into the business, and it's just a great conversation. One of my favorite episodes, definitely, so far. So enjoy the hell out of this one. Follow Brett on Twitter. Oh, and get his whiskey. He has his own whiskey. The Hill Haven Lodge is the name of his whiskey. Please get that. He gave Brad and I a bottle. It's fucking unreal. He wanted a whiskey that women could enjoy, that was like smooth, didn't have too much of a bite, and he hit this on the fucking head. Hill Haven Lodge whiskey. Go get it. Drink it. Love it. It's amazing. Follow Brett on Twitter at Brett Ratner. I'm at Adam Ray Comedy, at Funny Brad, at Ailen Podcast, at Ailen Podcast on Instagram, Adam Ray 33 on Instagram, Brad Williams Comic on Instagram. And come see us on the road this weekend. I am at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City, Utah on Thursday, November 10th at the Salt Lake City Wise Guys Comedy Club. First time there. So pumped. And then I'll be at the Wise Guys in Ogden on November 11th and November 12th. So one night at the Salt Lake City Wise Guys on November 10th and then November 11th and 12th at Wise Guys in Ogden. Get your tickets at AdamRayTV.com. The next weekend after that, November 17th to the 19th, I'm at Magoobies Comedy Club in Timonium, Maryland. That's right, Magoobies. Timonium, Maryland, which is not too far from Baltimore and D.C. So if you live in that adjacent area, come out and see me at Magoobies November 17th through the 19th in Timonium, Maryland. And then, of course, the Tempe Improv, November 23rd to the 25th in Tempe, Arizona. All those tickets and info at AdamRayTV.com. Brad Williams will be at the South Point Casino in Las Vegas at 12:30 on November 12th. Go see Brad, South Point, November 12th, Las Vegas. November 18th and 19th, Brad is headlining Flappers in Burbank. I was just there, had a blast. Go see Brad November 18th and 19th at Flappers Comedy Club in Burbank. And then November 25th through the 27th, Brad is in Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh Improv. Get your tickets at improv.com. And StoyMerchandise.com for all your ALN merch. You know that. Hat, shirts, mugs, posters. Go get them. They're a lot of fun. We got great designs, a lot of options. And bring them to the shows and we'll sign them for you. Take pictures, post them, show your support. Show your support with your tweets and your emails. Keep those coming. And tell somebody about the podcast. The ratings, the 5-star ratings and the reviews help on iTunes. Comments on the iTunes page. But tell somebody. Every time you listen to the pod, tweet at somebody, email a friend, tell a coworker, tell them to listen to the About Last Night podcast and spread the word. And show your support that way. We know you guys are loving it. We get your emails and your tweets and at live shows like in Erie, Pennsylvania, so many ALN fans, which was bonkers. And made me want to come out and do a live show with Brad there. So keep those coming. Tell somebody about the podcast, and tell them about today's episode, which I know you're going to love. Now that we got the Twitter handles out of the way, those are the tour dates. That's the merch info. And now sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with the one and only Brett Ratner.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and a dope podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's About Last Night.
Well, I thought making it was having your own whiskey, but it might be having your own your own bobblehead action figure, but with your Hebrew name on the box.
It has to be. It's a Jewish.
That's pretty
bobblehead. It's not a bobblehead. What is it called there?
Action figure.
Action figure.
Yeah, yeah.
Action
there is a distinct difference.
Yeah, that's bigger.
Yeah, I you don't play with. You don't fight your He-Man with a bobblehead.
There you go. And you may have said one of the more interesting sentences as we were walking in, getting set up to your beautiful home, which thank you so much for having us here. You said, I'm the king of Budapest.
Yeah.
How are you the king of Budapest?
Well, because I lived there for 9 months and I explored every crack and crevice of Budapest. So
how did you end up in
Budapest? I was shooting Hercules there with the Rock.
Yeah.
And so I lived there for almost a year, and I literally, I mean, I'm a foodie, as you could tell from my belly, and I went, I found every good restaurant. So whenever somebody goes or they say, I'm going to Budapest, which a lot of films are being made there.
I was in a little scene in Spy with Paul Feig, so I was there for a week, and I mean, ate out every night, and it was the best.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I had a great time there, and it didn't have some of my favorite shopping, but it was you know, there were definitely pretty girls in Budapest.
Oh,
that's for sure.
Did you do the I didn't get to do it, but the bath,
I didn't go because I'm a germaphobe, so I don't want to take baths with a bunch of strangers.
What is that a thing there? You go and you just
it's a public bath. I mean, I guess I guess the water is recirculating because it's from it's like from the earth.
Natural spring.
Yeah, it's a natural spring.
Sure.
So the water is kind of revolving, but I don't know. I'm a bit of a freak when it comes to water. Yeah.
Water. And thanks for taking the time to talk with us in between producing what seems like every film in Hollywood has the Rat Pack logo
that
comes
that cool?
on before it.
That wasn't a plan. That was by accident.
Really?
Yeah.
You guys have like, what, a 75 picture deal or with Warner Brothers
or something? Yeah, we agreed to finance 75 movies.
Yeah.
I think we've done 50 something. I can't even, I lost track at the last.
Yeah, but it's just every hit you just see the Rat Pack logo.
Yeah, but we're busy making films because before Rat Pack, it was just Rat.
Okay.
It's not like, I mean, I do love Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack, but it's more, it was Rat, which is short for Ratner. My nickname in high school was Rat. And then my partner's name was Packer. So he called me up one day and says, we should start a film company because we're the only two people that can have a company called Rat Pack and not look like we're trying to be like Rat Pack wannabes.
Trying to be cooler than we
Because your name's Ratner and my name's Packer. So we could
You can tell him that's the reason.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he was in the media business. He got out of the media business and got into the casino business. So he had a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
Hanging around, and he said, let's finance some movies. And I said, we do it, let's do it big. And so we made this deal with Warner Brothers. But separately, obviously, I was directing movies, but I was also producing movies.
Mm-hmm.
So we still produce films that we're not necessarily financing. So one part of the business is financing all these big movies, and the other part is still kind of
overseeing.
Coming up with ideas, original ideas, producing, developing stuff. You know, we do a lot of documentaries. We do about 10 to 15 documentaries a year.
No shit.
So I love docs. Docs is like
what's one of your favorites?
Well, one of my favorite docs ever made is probably The Kid Stays in the Picture, but just we made a doc on JT LaRoy now that just came out. That's amazing. We just did one on Carrie Fisher. We just did Leonardo DiCaprio's doc that's coming out October 30th.
Oh, no shit.
When is this here?
Next week.
October 30th.
Yes.
Oh, wait, when is that? That's like next week.
That'll be Sunday. So this will have come out.
On Nat Geo. It's called Before the Flood.
So it came out yesterday.
It's a climb. No.
No, I mean, when this airs on Monday.
Okay. It came out yesterday. Yeah. Check it out because it's going to be on everywhere. Facebook, Hulu.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Twitter, everything.
We'll and plug
it's,
it hard.
It's not, and Leonardo DiCaprio, it's kind of his journey for climate change. And it's not like Inconvenient Truth, which is a good informative film, but it was kind of, I would say, a little boring.
Mm-hmm.
This is Leo in every frame of the movie.
Wow.
With his perspective of what's, you know, of the issues.
Yeah, you've gotten to work with him quite a few times recently. You guys, Rat Pack, produced The Revenant.
Yeah, yeah.
So, good on you for that one.
That was unbelievable.
That was fun.
Do you, when that was even, I mean, I don't know what stage in it you saw, like, the bear attack scene.
Yeah.
But, like, was everyone just kind of collectively envisioning that? Or were you like, we have to make this
There was two big moments in the script that we knew and that, you know, Alejandro was fighting for. It was like, okay, and they were the most expensive ones, obviously, and then there were the big moments.
Yeah.
And that was the bear attack, and then when the horse jumped off the cliff.
And the camera follows him over.
Like goes all the way.
Right.
So that was the two big moments that we knew they were going to have in the film. And when I went up to Canada to see the director and to see his plan before he started shooting, I said, you got to show me how you're going to do this bear attack, because I can't even figure out how the hell you're going to do this and make it look real. Obviously, it was dependent on the execution of the visual effects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they had Leo tied onto a rope, and they were dragging him in the dirt.
Yeah.
You know, and the
viciously, probably.
Yeah. And the physicality of it. And then they had a guy in a suit, kind of as the bear.
Right, right.
So he can interact with something that was there in a green suit. But it was incredibly well crafted and designed shot by shot, moment by moment. But they had studied like bear attacks and bear mannerisms and bear.
But that's one of those scenes where if like the effects are bad and it's a weird cartoony
bear. It was
bear.
All dependent on that.
Yes, because it looks cheesy as hell. Yeah, but the fact that the realism was pulled off.
I mean, it will take you out of the movie, and there wasn't a false moment. I mean, the coolest moment I thought in the whole bear attack was when the bear gets close to the camera and he breathes.
Yeah, and the smoke goes on the camera.
Yeah, and the cold air. It was the cold air.
It fogs up the actual lens.
That was really a very cool.
Do you remember when you saw, I mean, you probably saw it in stages.
I saw different stages. I wanted to see it close to finish as possible. Yeah. I mean, I saw the pre-production.
Yeah.
So the storyboards and the animatics, they did animatics.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the rigs and all that stuff. But then I waited to see the final kind of until it was farther along. And I was blown away. I said, this is going to be one of the most great moments in cinematic history that people are not going to forget, this bear attack.
Oh, yeah. Everybody was talking. I mean, how many jokes about like people playing like, even Jonah at the Oscars, right? Was like, he came out as a bear.
Yeah.
Right. And then, there was The Rock and Kevin Hart did a whole song about it. Like that was the part of the movie, and the movie was such a cultural phenomenon that was the part everyone focused on.
Are you thinking Leo for the whole time? I mean, when you guys were putting it, does he get attached first? Is that kind of how that goes down?
Leo was cast. Yeah, when the movie got greenlit, I mean, it was the budget and everything was determined. I mean, Leo, you know, is the biggest movie star in the world that makes. Mm-hmm. You know, a movie.
Yeah, it makes like one movie a year, and it's always the best. So,
but it's, you know, it makes it worthwhile to invest as much money as we do. In a film, because he has a built-in audience. Yeah. You know, and
it's bankable.
Limits your risk.
Yeah. You know? Is it hard for you when you're wearing the producing hat?
Yeah.
Not to come in as a director and be like,
it's funny. People always like, what's the difference between a producer and a director? And it's always, you know, people are always somehow confused by it. But you know, obviously, a director is a storyteller. And works with the actors and, you know, sets up the camera and stuff. And there's many different types of producers on set. And I'm the type of director that wants my producer sitting next to me at all times. So if I have anything I need, anything I want to bounce off of, I want a collaborator. When I'm a producer, I don't want to be on set. Because I'm the guy, I don't want like, you know, actors saying, hey, what'd you think, bro? You know, because I'm I'm a director and I don't want to, I feel like I'm always stepping on the directors. So unless the director really wants me there, but most of the directors I work with are directors who I trust, who I believe in, who just go and shoot the movie. And I think my biggest contribution will be in post-production, because I've done it so many times.
You're there every step of the way.
In the edit room, with the score, you know, and every aspect of like the finishing of the movie.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily want to be hanging out on set. The only set I'd probably hang out on every day would be Polanski's set, Roman Polanski, because he's a master.
I mean,
there's like Stanley Kubrick, who's not here with us anymore, and then there's Roman Polanski. So I get to visit his set. I've been on a few of his sets, but I stay for like a week maybe the most. And
why is it so magical? Like from a director
standpoint? No, just because he's a master.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's 80 years old. Yeah. 80. How old is Roman? 83. I mean, he's been doing it for 60 years. He's, his early work, his student films are mind-blowing to me.
Oh, really?
He was born to do what he does. He just has a understanding of cinema and tone. And
so you just try to be there and soak up as much as you can. And
I just want, because you never, directors never get to see other directors' work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
As a producer, again, normally I would get to see other directors' work, but again, I don't want to be on set.
You know? Right, right, right.
But with Roman, I want to be there and just watch every... Not that I can... I mean, look, it's such an individual skill that I can't be like... It's not like I'm going to get hints from the way he... But I get inspiration from other movies.
Yeah.
So... Mm-hmm. Anything can inspire me, you know, not only just the performance, but just, you know, the way a set looks, the way a location looks. But at the end of the day, like anything, it's about taste.
Mm-hmm.
If you have good taste for jokes,
yes,
right, or bad taste for jokes,
yeah, exactly. You've seen my act, thank you.
If you have a sense of what an audience, a sense of what you like, and of what you like is what other people like, whatever you do, whether it's comedy or movies or anything. But if you have a sense of an audience, some people just have such unique taste that it's not accessible.
It's isolating.
It's just unique to them. It's not unique to what a mainstream audience is.
You say you get inspiration from other movies, like when you did Tower Heist, which is incredible. Did you watch other, like, I don't know, group comedies like that to kind of get
Yeah, I mean, I always love heists or caper films. Yeah. It's actually the second one.
Did you watch The Great
did.
Muppet Caper before you did that?
Of course. Yeah.
One of the greatest caper films
of all time. It's weird. Like, I did this movie, Family Man. But
again, one of my favorites.
Come on, you're just saying.
I swear to God. Dude, I was raised by two women, so I have a very sensitive side. Okay. And that movie is incredible.
So I love, you know, people are like, oh, I know what movie inspired you. It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah, I love It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't inspired necessarily. Yeah, I was inspired in some way, but not for that movie. For that movie specifically, I was inspired by a movie called Being There. Why? Has nothing to do with Family Man. Being There is with Peter Sellers, by the way.
Okay.
But it was a movie that was a comedy that was shot like a drama.
Oh, okay.
So the tone of Being There, because it was shot, it's a very real, very grounded, very serious film. Because how do you play, meaning a guy who's in an alternate universe? Like, where can I send Nick Cage to go, you know, on a Tower Heist? I can send Eddie to work with some, you know, Nutcrackers or, you know, safe crackers. I could send, you know, I could send on Rush Hour, Chris Tucker, Jake Chan to hang out with cops, you know, in L.A., but on a movie that you're existing in an alternate universe.
There's no training.
Yeah. And Nick was my inspiration because of Jimmy Stewart from It's a Wonderful Life, because Jimmy Stewart can be big in a movie, but he's still real.
Yeah.
And Nick can be way over the top. By the way, I just saw a great movie that he did, The Trust.
Yeah.
And he plays a cop. They're two Vegas cops.
Yeah.
Bad cops.
Nice.
But it is so good. And there's such twists and turns, and it was so really well directed. First time director. I don't know the director's name, but I love this movie, The Trust. But I love Nick Cage. It's my favorite.
Well, that's
actor.
Again why I love the movie so much, because he's such a born tough guy in so many of his movies, and he was to see the other side was really incredible.
That was the here's Peter Bogdanovich, famous film director.
Hello. Hey, Peter. making his walk through.
Yeah, you always have a house guest, whether it be Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Whether it be,
do you love hosting?
I like having people here. Yeah. I don't like being alone in this house.
Yeah, well, I mean,
not that the house is scary. I just like having guests.
Is that a Jewish thing? I'm very much the same way.
I like having friends.
Me too.
I always have people staying.
Oh man, that's the
best. I always. And my grandmother lives with me in the guest house right there.
That's the best.
Yeah. What I was going to say, by the way, backing up about Nick Cage. Nick Cage, I had to beg him. I mean, it took me 9 months to convince him to do this movie.
No kidding.
He was being offered Rollerball. And he was shooting Gone in 60 Seconds, and he had just come from that 8mm movie. And he was like in this dark mode.
Yeah.
And he was like, Brett, I don't want to, you know, I could see myself on a poster with baby with diapers. I don't want to do that. And I'm like, trust me, it's not that movie. So I gave him a tape. And I said, read the scene on page 20 with you, with the little girl talking about the aliens. And then watch this scene from Kramer versus Kramer when Dustin Hoffman is making the pancakes.
Yeah.
French toast with his son.
Yeah.
Then watch Terms of Endearment. So I gave him examples specifically for movies, so he understood what I was going for. Because you read it, you could have been like, "Oh, this is like, baby, what is that? What's that movie? Twins or whatever."
Oh, okay. Yeah,
or you could have read it
as the tone would be completely different.
Yeah, the tone, because you could read it because it was very funny.
Yeah.
Again, remember what I said about tone. I was trying to make Being There tone wise.
Mm-hmm.
It's a comedy, but I shot it like a drama.
Yeah.
So then I gave him examples of dramas. I didn't give him examples of comedies. He was reading and going, this is funny as shit. But I didn't go for the corny stuff.
Right.
I went for the real, you know.
Your knowledge of film, like just in this past 45 seconds, where you're bringing up all these past movies, where did this love of film come from?
The first movie I remember seeing that was a movie, because the first movie that I went to the theater was in 1976 that I can remember, was Paul McCartney in Wings.
Wow. Not the TV show.
No.
Okay.
It was Paul McCartney in Wings that did a concert film.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I remember Linda McCartney on, you know, up on the stage of the piano, whatever, and Paul McCartney. It was like, I remember sitting in the theater with my mom, and that was like the first film, but I ended up being in the theater. And actually, you got to check, because I don't even, who cares, but I mean, it was either Star Wars, obviously, because I remember it specifically, because I was dropped off at the theater. There was one theater, I was living in Las Vegas at the time. I grew up in Miami Beach, but for 2 years, my mom got married to this guy, and we moved to Las Vegas. And
wow.
That's another story. And I'm in line, this is when there's one screen, and literally my mom would drop me off at noon on Saturday, and she would pick me up at 8 o'clock at night, and I still not got into the theater. That's how long the fucking line was.
No kidding.
Yes. I would come back the next day And then I'd finally get into like the 8 o'clock. I'd have to go to the payphone and call my mom. I'm going to get into the 8 o'clock. So I'd wait at 12 o'clock. That's how, I mean, and so that's why I say a 6 year old kid, when I saw Star Wars, I guess it was the 76. Yeah. I was 6 or 7 years old. When I saw Star Wars, you know, a 7 year old kid can see that same Star Wars today. It won't have the same meaning.
No,
not at all.
And it's not because of the film. It's because of the experience, yes, and the excitement and the hype.
The anticipation, right, that goes along with it.
That I and the wait, the fact that I, yes, waited in line for 2 days.
Yes.
So imagine the anticipation. Imagine waiting in line for 8 hours. Nobody would do
imagine
it.
Imagine waiting.
Yeah, yeah, waiting. Well, there was no cell phone. I remember I had to go to the payphone, call my mom. I had like a roll of quarters, and I would call my mom, and I would say, Mom, I got into the 8 p.m. You know, don't pick me up until 10 or whatever.
Right.
10,
so you'd have somebody save your spot in line probably too?
Yeah, of course. I came with a few of my friends. But
and there's a lot of trust involved there.
You couldn't skip the line before, you know. No. And then I remember later when I got into NYU film school when I was 16, all I would do is sneak into movie theaters and I would look at the name of the director and say, I'm Brett, you know, Spielberg or whatever. And they go, oh, yeah, my father wanted me to see the film. Come on in.
Holy shit.
I never waited online again. I was like, yeah, I'm not waiting online.
Well, you've done your time.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, six. That. So, okay, so you're in Miami Beach, and then you go to Vegas, and that's, does your love of the biz just continue to grow there?
No, I mean, I love Star Wars, obviously. That was a big inspiration. Yeah. But the movie that did it was Raging Bull, surprisingly. My house was the house that you can watch R-rated, even X films. And, you know, kids would come over to my house because I didn't have it. My dad wasn't around, so we didn't have, like, porn. Most kids who had dads had porn tapes, yeah, right? My mom didn't have porn in the house. So my friends who had porn, whose dad had porn, would steal the porn, and we would come watch it at my house, because if they got caught watching the porn at their house, they'd get their ass beat. But at my house, my mom would be like, oh, you kids are silly. You know, she wouldn't.
You and your comedies.
Yeah. and so we're watching. I'll never forget. Speaking of that story, it was crazy. Is I remember a kid started having a panic attack while we were watching the porn.
Well, I mean, sure, that
double penetration is a lot for some
people.
He
was freaking out, and I chased him out of the house to be like, what's the matter? And he's like, I'm like, get it out, what's the matter? He's like, that's my uncle. We were watching Deep Throat, and Harry Reams was his uncle. His mother wrote a note. I mean, he wrote a note to me saying, yeah, I can't be your friend anymore, because he went crying to his mom.
Yeah.
I revealed the family secret. But
yeah, she had to.
I didn't, but okay, so.
Oh my God.
So then the mother, so my mom called the mother and said, how dare your son say he's not going to be friends with Brett anymore because, you know, your son was as guilty as Brett, yeah, watching the porn in the house. How can you? It's not my fault that your brother's a porn star.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, whatever. Exactly.
And just recently, the guy started instant messaging me on Instagram saying, hey, buddy, what's up? I hadn't heard from him in 40 years.
Oh, what was his opening line? Remember that scene?
Yeah. No, but did he quote the movie? He hasn't mentioned it, but it was like, you know, now that, you know,
time has passed.
Part of pop culture, it's on the internet everywhere. I think he's kind of got over it. But
yeah.
I think he was traumatized. But it was Harry Reams was Jewish. You know, wow. He's like the first Jewish porn star.
I was just going to say, Heyman wasn't a porn star. How are you with people reaching out from your past at this point? Like,
yeah, it doesn't bother. I mean, you know, I didn't go to I was sad I didn't get to go to my 30th reunion because it's in Miami Beach and there's Zika down there, so I don't want to catch Zika.
It's probably a good move.
I'd like German to have folks, a kid in 2017.
Yeah.
Well, hell, you could probably just fly them all out here.
Yeah, exactly.
Film school at 16, that's bananas, right?
Well, what happens, I saw Raging Bull, and I was like, you know, upset. I'm like, how did this guy, Martin Scorsese, become a director? Well, he went to NYU Film School. I said, well, that's where I'm going to go. I thought about it every day, but I'm 10. You go to college when you're 18. That 8 years is almost your entire life when you're 10 years old.
Yeah, it is your entire life at that point.
So I was like,
to wait another lifetime.
This is crazy.
This.
So I went to my mom and said, Mom, you know, I'm not learning anything in class. She goes, what do you mean? He goes, these kids are idiots. I'm not learning anything. I want to skip a grade, or, you know, whatever. So she went and complained to the principal, and they skipped me 2 grades. So that's how I graduated. I was the shortest kid, speaking of short.
Hell yeah.
I was the shortest kid in high school because I was 16 as a senior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even have my driver's license by the time I graduated. I got it like the last 2 months of school. And I was, so I graduated, but I also stopped doing homework because I was like, why am I going to do homework? I'm going to be a director. I was kind of like Woody Allen.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, why am I going to do homework?
Yeah, you knew what you were going to be.
Yeah, I knew what I was going to be. And so I went to my guidance counselor, said, you got to go to an interview at the school, you know, with admissions office, because maybe that you'll, you know, you're charming, Brett, you'll convince them, and, you know, maybe you could show them your film. So I go with my little projector.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I had a 3-piece suit on. I flew Eastern Airlines. It was like $65 to go up to New York. I went alone. I was
16.
Yeah, I brought my projector with my best film, and I go into the admissions office, and they send me into the office. The woman's not there yet; she's out getting coffee, whatever. She'll be right back. So I start setting up my reels, and I'm about to project it on her wall when she walks in. I'm turning off the lights, everything ready. She's like, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm showing you my film." She goes, "We don't look at film." So I'm like, "Am I in the wrong building? What do you mean? Isn't this NYU film school?" Like, "No, we don't look at films. This is academics." I'm like, "No, no, just watch my film. You'll understand." She goes, "No, no, young man." I'm like, "This is NYU film school, right?" She's like, "Yes, but we don't look at films." I'm like, "That's ridiculous." So she opens up my file. She doesn't realize I'm 16. She goes, "Young man, you have the worst grades of any students ever applied to this school." Because I was so presumptuous. She said, "You're not getting in." She's not supposed to tell you that, because I think kids sometimes, if you tell the kid that he can't get in, then he hurts himself, they're liable.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
So they send a letter like a month later or whatever.
Right, saying you didn't get in.
So I said, don't worry about that. Just watch my film. So like, you should go to Dade Community College, where you're from, in Miami, for 2 years, get straight A's, and then maybe we'll consider letting you in. I said, "This is ridiculous." "No, no. What's ridiculous is that you're still standing in my office. Have a good day, Mr. Ratner."
And snap.
Like, kicks me out. And I thought my life was over. Because I'm 10 years old, I'm thinking of going to NYU film school. I literally am told I'm not getting in. I'm walking down the street. I can't call my mom because it's a long day. I couldn't call collect, but I was just like so upset. And I think, I can't let this person decide my future. I'm going to go to the dean's office. So I asked the first person that's wearing an NYU t-shirt, "Where's the dean's office?" They go, "Oh, he's on the top floor of that building. He has a little old secretary, one of those appointment books."
Yeah.
And I say, "Hi, I'm here to see the dean." And they said, "Do you have an appointment?" I go, "No." They go, "Okay." And she goes like 10 pages past. She goes, "Okay, 3 months from now, on the third Thursday of the month, you can see the dean for 10 minutes. And I go, "No, no, you don't understand, miss. This is life or death." And she says, "Okay, hold on." And I felt like
2 months.
I felt like Charlie Sheen. I felt like Charlie Sheen in waiting for Gordon Gekko to go into his office. Like, I was sitting there going, and all of a sudden she goes, "Okay, come in, young man." And I go, "Dean, my whole life I dreamed of being a director." I said, "But if you don't let me in, I'm going to be living on my mom's couch for the rest of my life, you know?" And he says, "Okay, get me this kid's file." And I go, "You shouldn't look at the file, trust me.
Because it's
not great. Good.
It's not
good." But it's ridiculous that this woman wouldn't look at my student film. And long story short, I go back. My mom is like, "Oh, don't worry. You'll see what happens." I'm like, "Oh," I was like so nervous. I open the letter. It says, "You've been accepted to NYU Film School."
And
that was a defining moment in my life. Because if I would have got to know, I still would have become a director. But I would have taken a completely different path. So when I got the yes, it just gave me so much confidence, you know.
Think about that for a second. Every kid who's, and every adult who's probably listening to this has.
Every 10-year-old who's listening.
Yeah, like,
with a dream.
I got rejected from a college. It would never go into my mind, like, going to the dean's office and say, "Hey, fuck you, let me in anyway." Yeah. Like, and then to have it work.
I don't know if it could work today. I think it was kind of meant to be, like, I that went there. And by the way, when I went there, it was no easy task, because every single kid was the son or the daughter of somebody famous. I mean, it was like, I didn't know nobody. I was from Miami Beach, and everyone like was the son of some studio head or some director, some producer. Yeah. And I was like, Jesus Christ. Every day I wanted to quit, because I would see a film that would blow me. I mean, I wish I could find those kids today, because they were so freaking talented. But see, the most talented ones are the laziest ones.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, because
you were working so hard because you were.
I would work on. Everyone was trying to get laid or get high or party, and that's why I never drank or did drugs to this day, because everybody was always partying.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like I was keeping equipment on the weekends, when you weren't supposed to, and shooting while everybody else was partying in college. They were in college. They wanted to party. But I was like, shit, if I work harder, I'm going to, and I became one of the most successful directors that ever came out of film school, because I worked harder than all the kids who were way more talented than I was.
What would you shoot on the weekends?
Well, I would just do pickup shots or just get extra footage or shoot a scene again, or I would just keep, it's.
Well, also you're looking
at these kids. Practice makes perfect.
Yeah. You're looking at these kids that who you described as they're a studio head kid or a director's niece or something.
Yeah, yeah.
They have the fallback. They have the, it's all right.
And they have a little bit of entitlement, and they also and they were really talented. I don't know where they learned how to make these films. I'm like, Jesus. I mean, I had made 100 films before I went to film school, but little short, little tiny, little movies. Yeah. So I was like, Jesus Christ.
I'm curious where you get your perseverance from. I have a very Jewish mother, and she's instilled in me, you create your own good luck, and you don't ask, you don't get. And it's like, you know, there's obviously a difference between being proactive and like nagging somebody, but like, I mean, is that where you get that from? Or?
Yeah, I think I get it from my family, but I just think I had a real desire. I had, it wasn't ever about getting rich. I never knew I'd have a house and like this. I never knew I'd have any car I wanted. I never knew I had, I mean, I wanted girls, but I never wanted, I never thought.
That drives
I,
everything.
Yeah, yeah. I never, it wasn't for something. It was like, I had a strong desire to make movies. Like you have a desire to tell jokes. Yep. You just, it's in you. You're,
you
have to. When you're on stage, you're born to do what you do, yeah. right? It's the same for me. I don't know what you do.
I'm a comic too.
Okay, good. Okay. So I haven't seen your comedy, but I'm sure you're funny as shit. You're good. You're funny now.
Thanks.
But what I'm saying is people have a desire in them to do things, and it was always for the right reasons. I always, when I go to speak at film schools, I'm like, if you're doing this to, because you want to be famous, it's never going to happen. If you're doing this because you want to be rich, it's never going to happen. You got to love it because, you know, and oh, by the way, when I was at NYU Film School, my, this is crazy. You're going to love this because you guys are comics. My classmate was Peter Shore, or he was a year ahead of me.
Yes.
Pauly Shore's brother.
Right, yes. Right.
So he did a film. Fuck, I can't remember the name. I'm so old.
With Pauly in it?
Well, Pauly was in it, but I was in it. He asked me, came up to me, I don't know, and goes, hey, man, I want, because I was the caricature of a Hollywood director. Everyone was like independent. Mm-hmm. You know, they made films about someone dying of cancer or someone dying.
Sure.
And I was like,
long, slow,
I was
black
like,
and white.
Whatever happened to Mason Reese is my student film, the child star.
Oh, wow.
Remember that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow. And I used Mike Anderson in it.
No shit.
Yeah. You remember Mike Anderson from Twin Peaks?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah. So I was always, I was, you know, and people were like not taking me seriously. I ended up winning the NYU Film Festival, but no one took me seriously. I remember meeting two guys. One's an agent now. One's not with us anymore, but two guys who were producers. They were like the team. They were like Simpson Bruckheimer of NYU. Mm-hmm. And I said, can I have a meeting with you guys? I want you to produce my short film. They said, okay, you need to submit it to us. They take me for lunch. They said, we're going to pass. I was like, this is crazy. We're in film school. This isn't fucking Hollywood. But they were acting like they were literally, you know, like Hollywood producers, which was hysterical. And so Peter put me up. Everyone, I guess people are making fun of me saying, oh, Brett's a joke. No one took me
that
seriously.
That just drives you harder, right?
Yeah. And well, I didn't know, really. And then he put me in the film playing a director who was always, because I would always say, I got Mason Reese in my film. I always bragging to everybody about it. I ended up getting money from Steven Spielberg. From Kathy Kennedy sent me a check.
I heard this story. I wanted to know if it was true. It's something like you wrote like what, like the top,
well, this is what happened.
50 directors on Forbes?
Yeah, what happened was, so I'm at NYU. I'm like thinking I'm going to quit. I'm never going to be as good as these guys. And I'm like, NYU teach you how to make films. They don't teach you how to get a job.
Right.
Same with the USC Theater School, by the way.
Okay.
Like, get the training and then they're like, fucking good luck.
Then good luck.
Yeah.
So I get a film, I get a magazine and it says the 40 most powerful people in entertainment. And I go back to my dorm, and this is back in the day when you would call 818-555. There was no internet. 818-555-1212. And I would say, can I have the number for Warner Brothers Pictures? And then I would say, can I get the address? And I would address the chairman. And I would address whoever was on that list, the chairman of Warner Brothers, the chairman of Sony, the chairman of Disney, the chairman of, you know, and all the big directors and producers. And I sent off a letter out with my film to all of them, and I got 39 rejection letters. But I didn't feel like I was being rejected. I felt like I had a relationship with you.
Get a response.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm like, one day I'm going to go to you and say, you sent me a letter, and I still have all the letters.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the dean of the film school calls me, and I think I'm getting kicked out because, remember, I was cheating. I was keeping equipment on the weekends.
Yeah, right.
I was like, you know, trying to get ahead. And I didn't feel like I belonged there because I had to talk my way in, and I'm like, okay, I'm not part of this, you know, school. The dean comes in, sit down, Brad. He's like kissing my butt. And I'm like, what, why are you kissing my butt? I was like, kid, I'm like, why? I was like 17 years old. He's like, you won't believe who called here looking for you. I'm like, who? He's like, Steven Spielberg. I'm like, let me stop you there. I know it was my mother and my grandmother pretending because they want me to do well here. I'm so sorry they wasted your time.
Right.
They're pretending they were Steven Spielberg's secretary. Don't even.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry about that. I'm literally like, never in a million years did I think it was true. And then I go back to my dorm and I call the number, just check in, and they answer the phone. Steven Spielberg's office. I'm like, is Mr. Spielberg in? Who's calling? Brett Renner. Oh, hold on. He's expecting your call.
what?
And then she goes, can he call you back? So my mom calls me 37 times a day. I had to hang up on her because I didn't have call waiting back.
Yeah.
No. You had to keep that line
I got to keep it phone clear.
Yeah.
And then I woke up in the morning with like slobber on the phone. It was this woman, Kathy Kennedy. Now I couldn't just Google Kathy Kennedy. I didn't remember she produced E.T. and I don't remember all the producers' names. And she goes, you know, I'm calling you on behalf of Steven. I go, well, can I speak to Steven? They're like, no, you can't because he was busy. You know, he's in production.
Sure, he's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. So I said, but we wanted to speak to you both, and we wanted to tell you how impressed we were with your student film. And we don't give money for film students, but if you ever have a feature. And I'm like, no, but you don't understand. I kept her on the phone for like 10 minutes. And I just hung up and I thought I was the man. I just felt good.
Of course.
And a few weeks go by. guy. I walk into my mailbox and I open it up, and there's a check from Steven and Kathy Kennedy and from Amblin Entertainment. Right. And I blew it up the size of my entire wall. I put it like literally, I would carry it in my wallet till it was like the last day the check expired.
Yeah.
And would show it to girls and to try to impress them.
You know, like, yeah. That's a great
And
thing
I was ready to
use.
Put Steven Spielberg presents a Brett Ratner. I was going crazy, you know. Like, but it was another defining moment in my life because it gave me so much confidence.
Yeah.
And it made me, it wasn't that Steven Spielberg found me. It just, it gave me huge validation.
You need those little, even in comedy, like we need, whether you get into a festival or you get a late night spot, these little like things along the way are like keep you going for another 2 years, you know?
So I was in Peter Shore's film and I meet Paulie one day and he's like, "You're the funniest one in the movie." And I'm like, "Oh, come on. God, I got to find that movie, Kasha."
And that's just you playing.
Me playing myself.
Yeah.
A film student who's like obnoxious and whatever. And so Paulie becomes my best friend, and he was treating me like shit, by the way. And I he would say to me, you know, I was living up at the house above the comedy store with him.
Okay.
I would go up for like, you know, weeks at a time. He was like, had girls like fucking on rotation every, and I had to sleep on the couch.
You can stay, but the couch is where you're
going to
be.
Yeah, exactly. He wouldn't share. We would go down. The first time I went to the Comedy Store actually was with Anthony Michael Hall, was my best friend, and Robert Downey Jr. We flew out from New York to LA to see Sam Kinison, and Anthony Michael Hall and Robert Downey were heckling Sam Kinison from the back of the audience, and Kinison started, he was obviously coked up.
Sure.
And in a rage, and he would like, he was like, you know, fucking screaming at him. He didn't know it was them because they were disguising their voices.
Right,
I was sitting next to them crying. I mean, I was like, I'm like the Zelig of film directors. I've been places like where shit happened. I mean, I was at China Club when Rick James, there's a famous picture of Rick James and Eddie Murphy in the China Club, the story that Eddie's brother, I was there at that club when that picture was taken. Like literally, my life was crazy. But I was always around comedy.
Yeah.
And so my first exposure was with Anthony Michael Hall and Robert Downey Jr., who had just done SNL together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they loved Kinison. They were trying to convince Kinison. I think it was Back to School. It was Back to School, the movie that Kinison was in.
Yeah, with Robert Rodney
Dangerfield. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Oh, thank you, sir.
So it was. So they wanted Sam Kinison to be in.
Are you good on time? Like 25 more minutes. You good?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And they wanted Robert to be in. They wanted Kinison, and I was there when they were heckling him. And I think Paulie came, but whatever. So Paul became my friend, and he would shooting this thing on MTV called The Weasel.
Yeah.
And he was like, and I said, let me direct one of the episodes because I'll direct anything. I'll direct the fucking.
Just trying to get experience.
Yeah. I would direct a fucking infomercial if someone asked me. I was like ready to direct. And he was like, shut up. You're not a director. I'm the director of The Weasel. You know, you're not the fucking, he goes, you could be the rat. So there's an episode somewhere that I was on a whole week where he made me do the most ridiculous, stupid shit.
I am YouTubing all of that tonight.
And I was the rat and he was the weasel. And it was a week. And it was so embarrassing, whatever. And he would treat me like shit. And I should have sued him because son-in-law was me and my girlfriend at the time, Rebecca Gerhardt, was from Kentucky. And all those stories I told him, he kind of stole. But
I'm not gonna
I love Paulie. I'm not going to sue him.
Sure.
But then all the time that I spent at the Comedy Store, and then back in New York, when I was in NYU, Russell Simmons, who was my best friend, was, you know, the godfather of hip hop, and he started the show called the Def Comedy Jam.
Yeah,
so he would ask me to go and watch all the comedians, the black comedians in the clubs at the auditions for the Def Comedy Jam.
That's incredible.
He had a guy picking the comedians, but he trusted me because I was like my white perspective, my white Jewish
community.
And he thought I was really funny. So I called him up one day and I said, you got to get this guy, Chris Tucker. He's the funniest motherfucker. He goes, oh, yeah. You know, we'll get him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked up to Chris and I was a music video director at the time. I said, I'm doing a music video for Heavy D called Nothing But Love and I want you to be in the video.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, how much are you going to pay me, man? And I said, $500. He goes, no, man, I need $1,000. I go, I don't have it. He goes, can I keep the wardrobe? And I said, yeah. So I put him in the video.
Look at him negotiating already.
It was the first time he'd ever been on camera.
Wow.
It was before he shot his Def Comedy Jam, Chris Tucker. He was like 19 years old. I have a picture of him at Polaroid that I took of him that day.
No kidding.
And he was, I did the video. It was the biggest video on MTV.
Mm-hmm.
And
when videos mattered.
Yeah. And and my name would be on and it would show every 5, 10, 15 minutes. Jeez, whatever.
Exactly.
And then Madonna and Mariah Carey and D'Angelo and all the big artists started asking me to do videos. And I started doing well from that video. Before I was struggling. and I had money, and I sent him the check 3 months later for the other 500 that he asked me for. And I guess he got it when he really needed it.
Oh, wow.
When he really needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And he never called me to thank me, but I got a copy of the cash check.
Mm-hmm.
Because he signed it on the back.
Right, exactly.
That's when you would get your checks in the mail, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he said, and so never heard from him again. He went on to do Friday.
Mm-hmm.
He got $15,000. Went on to do Dead Presidents. He got $25,000 to star in Dead Presidents. Then he was about to do this movie, A New Line, called Money Talks with Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
The director, a week before shooting, went to see the head of the studio, Mike DeLuca, and said, the director says, you know, this kid, Chris Tucker, will only improvise. He won't say the lines on the page. Well, the head of the studio goes, well, what do you suggest we do? He goes, let's fire him. And he's like, let's get another black guy. And the head of the studio says to the director, you're fired.
Nice.
Gets rid of him. Calls in Chris Tucker. What are we going to do? We're shooting in 1 week. Every week that we don't shoot is going to cost us $1 million. He goes, I remember this cool white boy, Brett Ratner.
What?
Shut the fuck up.
And I have not seen him in years.
No shit.
Since that. But he remembered what a great experience it was and how great the video was.
Yeah.
And the chemistry that we had together. And he put my name out there. Mike DeLuca had known I already done big music videos.
Yes.
So I'd become like a big music video director. So I'm like, oh, I heard of Brett Ratner. Yeah, let's do it with him.
Yeah, because he's like, Chris, you like him. You're vouching for him.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And I jumped in with a week prep, and Money Talks is my first movie, which I think is funnier than all the Rush Hours.
That's, oh my God.
And, oh, and funny Rush Hours.
And that's a lesson really for people out there, because, you know, monetary remuneration is a byproduct of excellence. And when you pay somebody, even, it's not even paying, even a note. If I would have just sent him a note, maybe, I think the money worked better, but a note even to say, thanks for doing a great job. You know,
sure.
When someone appreciates when they deliver for you, mm-hmm. and you reciprocate, whatever, it doesn't have to be, you know, a money or a gift.
Yeah,
it could be a note.
Just letting them know that, hey, I know you.
That comes back
out.
And it came back. I mean, millions of times.
Oh my God!
I can't even tell you. I was paying him so 3 years before, I paid him $500. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We do Money Talks. It's a hit. We do Rush Hour. He gets paid $1 million. By Rush Hour 2, he's gotten $20 million. And 20% of the gross, he made $50 million. And for 3 or 4 years before, I paid him $500.
Yeah.
And what? I made a fortune too. So it's like, it just shows you, like, you know, thinking,
one little thing.
Remembering when somebody does good for you and appreciating that, it will pay off eventually. And now, and by the way, comedy is like, I watched all these, you know, everybody come up, every one of these guys. Obviously, mm-hmm. the Def Comedy Jam, because it's Jamie Foxx.
And being associated with
Martin
Russell
Lawrence and all these guys and stuff. And I saw them. But that was my training, watching all these comedians at the time. And I would watch Chris Tucker do a set and say 2 or 3 jokes didn't work. And he mm-hmm. would come back and do the second set.
Yeah.
And those exact 3 jokes that didn't work would kill.
Yeah.
Because he just would deliver them differently.
Yeah.
He would learn from it, right?
Yeah. He knew how to make adjustments just real quick.
Yeah, he makes adjustments. And I realized that. So whenever I couldn't get something out of him, I would show him the playback
mm-hmm.
on the monitor. He would see it and come back and do it. And once he would own it, and stuff that wasn't, you know, that he didn't get, like, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. He didn't know what the fuck Mr. DeMille, what the reference was. You know. And I would show him the reference in front of the movie.
Okay, so then he got it.
And then he would get it and own it. And he would make it his own. And so he was brilliant. It was a brilliant.
Did you know he was on Rush Hour, I mean, it was like, he just, it was like movie, it was like, you're a movie star. Like, in the, did he have that same pop when
he
first saw him in the music video?
I saw him on stage when he did it.
Yeah.
I saw him because I looked through this is when Bernie Mac and all these guys were
all the
around,
classic, all the classic Def Jam sets.
Really talented guys. Chris had a charisma. He had a handsome thing going. He also, was able to pull off dramatic moments, you know, which a lot of comedians sometimes are just funny,
right?
Where Chris can be real too. And I begged him to do Jackie Brown. Quentin called me and said, Chris has turned me down 6 times. I sent him the script. He won't read it. He won't do it. Called him. We're on a plane. Every time I got Chris to do something, I start crying, but I fake cry. You know? And he goes, don't cry, but white boy, come on. I love you, Brad. I love you, Brad. He calls me. He doesn't even, for 30
Jewish
years.
Guilt.
I've known him for, I don't know, how many years? 20 something years.
Yeah.
He still calls me Brad. He doesn't know my name's Brett, right?
That's
Brad.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Are the checks made out to Brett?
Yeah. And so he's like, so I go, we're on a plane. I wait till you have to trap him. So we're on a mm-hmm. plane going to like South Africa somewhere. And I'm like, Chris, you know, I just read Quentin's script. Yeah, man. He wants me to do a cameo, man. I don't know cameos. I'm not doing that. I go, Chris, I don't care if he asks you to walk through the frame. It's a Quentin Tarantino movie. it will be a classic.
Yeah.
You have to do it. Man, I'm not doing that, man. I'm a movie star, man. I'm starring movies. I don't do that shit. I'm like, Chris, you got to do it. Trust me. Please, I'm begging you. And I literally spent, I think, 14 hours.
The whole flight, ear. Yeah.
And then when he got, fine, man, fine. Can I tell Quentin you're going to do it? Yeah, I can tell. Don't embarrass me, Chris. I'm doing it, man. Don't worry. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I read him the scene. Mm-hmm. I told him how funny he was. It was, remember how brilliant that's?
Oh, it was unbelievable.
It's so quick, but it stands
it's
out.
Real. And it's so fucking real, yeah. Because he created this character and he was brilliant. I mean, I remember him calling me freaking out because we had just done Money Talks and he was shooting Luc Besson's movie in England.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, man, this Prince should have done this shit. This ain't. And Prince, he tried to try to get Prince to play that part.
Wow.
He's like, man, this is not right, man. I'm my people are not going to like this, you know. My people in Decatur, Georgia, you right. know, they're very judgmental. He didn't say judgmental, but that's what he meant. Like, you know,
God,
I don't know how I'm going to walk around the hood in this after with this outfit they got me in, Brad.
Yeah. Wait, so did you find Jackie Chan? I mean, was that like
Jackie Chan's amazing. I mean, working with Jackie Chan is the equivalent of working, I think, with Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, and Charlie Chaplin in one.
The just guy, a master.
Oh, he's everything. A master. I mean, I've learned more about filmmaking than this guy, and I'll just give you an example of two different scenarios. But
mm-hmm.
I mean, if I tell him I have, you know, he goes, what size lens? He'll just go, what lens? And I go 50, and he'll know where his focus is. Where actors, I go, Chris, man, you're out of focus. You got to step up to it. You know, I have to put marks down for actors. You got to light and everything. Jackie Chan knows the light, knows the focus.
He's so aware of his surroundings.
He's a director, writer, actor, editor, cinematographer. He could do every job. Gaff. He could gaff. He could be the dolly grip. He could do every job on the set. I mean, Chinese movies, that's the way they did it.
Yeah.
So there were two instances where a lot of frustration on Rush Hour because I was a young kid and mm-hmm. I'm doing this huge movie and fucking doing dangerous shit and people, they had like safety people on set watching me the whole time.
This is your first big, I mean,
Money Talks was my first movie. It was
right.
But Rush Hour is bigger, but it was under the radar. Nobody was paying attention. No one mm-hmm. thought a movie, remember only Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt movies and all these movies were hits.
Right.
There was no movie with a black guy and a Chinese guy that was so big, as big as ever. It was okay. Like,
yeah, exactly.
And so it was under the radar, but except they had safety people on set watching me, you know, like Brett's, you know, because they knew Jackie Chan was prone to do shit without clipping in the
he
wire.
He does his own stunts.
You
know, he just does it.
Make sure no one gets hurt on set because Jackie might be able to convince Brett to let him do it. And And remember, there was a scene in the movie. I don't remember when they're running in this abandoned building downtown, and the bad guy throws an axe at Chris, and it sticks in the wall next to him. So the producer's there. He's like, okay, you got to do this digitally. I'm like, oh, that's going to look like shit. This is before digital
effects,
mm-hmm. you know? And I'm like, you know, no, Jackie's like, let me show you how to do this. I'm like, yeah. And so it's hard to describe visually, but it's basically, he stood underneath the camera mm-hmm. and took the axe. There was two, he said, get me two axes. And just went like, put the axe in front of the lens, spun it twice. So it looks like it was rotating, but it was right there in front of the lens.
Oh, and that's two different axes?
No, one axe is in front of the lens and it just rotates once or twice around.
Yeah.
Then he drops it out of frame and then someone below the frame line where it's supposed to stick in the wall sticks it in the wall.
Oh, shit.
So it was so it spins in front of you. It's an optical illusion.
Yeah.
And I would have never thought of that. I mean, we did it in one take. It cost nothing. It would have cost like $100,000 to have an axe go through the wall. And thing.
Right.
Chris could react to it because I'll thump you with the thumb.
Yeah.
He could react to it. You know, meaning he just went like this and released it. It was below the frame line. So he just threw it in the wall. So there's someone here with an axe and someone over there with an axe. So there's two axes.
And that was all Jackie Chan setting that up.
Jackie Chan said, let me show you how to do this.
Amazing.
Or stuff like we had to do a crane shot and where someone had to peek over the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you got to get a crane up to the roof. You got to rig the crane. It took like 12 hours, literally. Mm-hmm. I mean, with 18 guys carrying this fucking crane, because it's like a crane that you can operate. That won't fall off the roof if you go over the side. And Jackie was like, this is ridiculous. This fucking Hollywood. Brett, can I just try to go? Well, Jackie, I can't hang you out there. No, just please. And I said, fine. So you get a rope. Mm-hmm. Eight guys hold him. He puts the camera up to his face. And they slowly let out slack. And he just his whole body is like is stiff, and the camera's at his eyes, and he just kind of, he becomes a crane arm. Holy and they just shit. Let him down, and he's parallel with the building. And they're like, all right, pull me up. And I go, done, got a bread, and then we pull me up. I mean, it was like,
no,
I mean,
shit.
The lessons were just like, because it was the practical way, they used what they had.
Yeah.
It was never so. There was this one scene where I had to convince, the best scene, I had to convince Chris Tucker. Remember when he was nude in the movie, which was the biggest movie? Now, Chris Tucker had a nudity clause where he had to prove it, and he wasn't going to be nude in the movie.
Okay.
So I got his double butt naked with Jackie Chan, and it was on the freeway in Hong Kong.
Okay.
You can't block off the freeway in Hong Kong.
No.
You don't get permits.
No.
So he's like, ah, fuck you. I'm so mad. I can't believe you're making me do this. Use my double. I go, no, I need to at least to see you. You got to turn towards the camera. I was a block away on the roof of a building with like a 1,000-millimeter lens. Literally, the lens was like 3 feet long. And the focus has to be perfect and whatever. We prepped it. We lined it up. And Jackie and the double are butt naked in a car, and they get kicked out of the car butt naked. So they're he's covering his dick.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm doing this once, Brad. Do not ask me to do this again, right? Eight cars slamming the brakes. He's running across the freeway butt naked. A car slams on its brakes next to him and asks Jackie Chan for his autograph. And I go, oh, fuck, the shot was ruined.
Yeah.
And Jack comes on, fuck you, Brad. Yeah. Okay, I do it again. Fuck you. He was so pissed off.
Wow.
And so we did it, and it ended up in the movie. And I didn't show it to Chris.
Yeah.
And then when Chris saw the movie, the audience was screaming when they were naked in the movie. I mean, like screaming. It was like the biggest moment.
Oh, my God.
And so, yeah, so working with Jackie Chan and Chris, and hopefully we'll make a Rush Hour 4. We're trying to come up. It's so hard. We've done everything. It's so hard.
I was going
to
say,
and it's like, we've been to Paris. We've been to Vegas. We've been to Hong Kong.
Right.
Maybe we'll go to China.
Where do
but
you
it's
go?
Like, we're trying to figure it out. And look, the kids have grown up. I mean, there's a big audience out there for it, but we got to be smart.
He's probably still just as in shape and like, just as willing to put his body in harm's way.
Grumpy old Rush Hour, we'll call it.
I mean,
you could be the Joe Pesci from Lethal Weapon in the middle.
Oh, so like I'm in between them?
Yeah.
Whatever. I can't talk faster than Chris Tucker. We gotta figure something out there. But yeah, I'm in. Then was the chemistry between them just
instantaneous,
or was it?
That's why the movie works so well. People are like, oh, Brett's a genius, and I knew it was gonna work. And because if it didn't work, the movie wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
But after Money Talks, the studio's like, what do you want to do? I go, I want to do a movie with Chris. I grew up, I did the Wu-Tang video, remember Triumph?
Shut up.
And I did, as I grew up around Kung, I did martial arts, I watched every Bruce Lee movie, every Jackie Chan movie I knew, and I'm like, I want to do a movie with Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker. So I flew to South Africa to convince Jackie Chan to have, I flew to South Africa 28 hours to have lunch with Jackie Chan. Okay, to convince him, and I don't know if he was going to do it.
Yeah.
And I come back, and he finally says yes. That's a whole long story, and I won't get into it, it's a long story, but the first time they met was in an office at William Morris, right? And Chris's like, I love Jackie Chan, man. I love him. I love him. We go into a room. Mm-hmm. Jackie's got like eight guys with him. It's me and Chris. And Chris talking, Jackie, I love you, man. You're the best. I love you, Kung Fu, man. I want to do that shit. I want to teach me how to do that shit. I can do that. I'm cool. I'm bad. And Jackie's shaking his head, and Jackie starts to talk. And Chris goes, can I talk to you, Brett? Yeah, come outside for a minute. I come outside. He goes, what are we going to do? I go, what do you mean? He goes, Jackie Chan don't speak English. I go, what do you mean? He goes, I don't understand a damn word he's saying. I can't understand. Can we make a movie with him? I go, it's going to be fine, Chris. I promise. Mm-hmm. I go back inside. Jack goes, I like Chris Tucker. I go, you like him and you're excited? He goes, yes, but I don't understand what he's saying.
Oh, my God.
I said, perfect. This is going to be fucking genius.
That's the line.
And we use it in the movie. So every time I go, Chris, I give him a signal. He'd be like, you don't speak English, do you? Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Yeah.
That was all real. That was shit. Like, they didn't understand.
That catchphrase was quoted so much.
Jackie would remember phonetically his lines.
Right.
And he would get cued by the last word in Chris, but Chris would never say the last word because Chris would always say his lines out of order.
And he would improvise.
And he would, well, he would say what the meaning was, but he would never say it. He would say it in his Decatur way.
Right.
He would say it in a different way than what was written there.
Yeah.
So that word never came. So I'd have to signal Jackie, but then I would always have to do a lot of make sure that it made sense. My whole job was managing to make sure that it made sense.
Right.
Talking to each other, because half the stuff that they said to each other, they didn't understand what they were saying to each other. You know, Chris is from Decatur, his country, you know, and his English is very country. And Jackie like had no clue as to what was being said. Conversationally, Jackie's good, but when he has to read lines, it was like, and he could jump off a building like with a blink.
Yeah.
But to read lines, he would have like a nervous breakdown. It was crazy.
Shit. So the same way you showed like Chris stuff with Jackie's probably, or did he just know of him?
I showed him Money Talks.
So did Jackie? Okay, you showed Jackie Money Talks.
This is how I got Jackie to do the film. I went to see him. I said, Jackie, you've been making movies longer than I've been alive. I was 27 at the time. Jackie's been making movies for like 30 years. I said, you know, I love your movies, but here's the problem. Your movies don't work in the United States. They were only doing like $4 or $5 million at the box office.
Yeah.
I said, because you have a 20-minute fight sequence or a cult thing. Mm-hmm. You're only fighting stuntmen. You're not fighting real villains, real characters. I said, this should be like a Bond movie. I said, you know, where there's a great villain, beautiful women, you know, and Jackie, your physical comedy and Chris's verbal comedy will be a great combination. Fish out of water. You know, mm-hmm. I explained this to him. And I said, Chris is a brilliant, you know, comedian, but your physicality and Chris's, you know, thing, Chris is almost like a, you know, cartoon character also, you know. And I said, the two of you together will be really special. But I didn't really know if they had that chemistry. But when I saw them in the room and they didn't understand what they were saying to each other, I said, this is going to be brilliant. Oh, I said, this is going to work. I just knew it.
That's incredible.
And people think, the great thing about the movie is you think that they hung out 24 hours a day.
Yes.
Best friends. Thought. They would go in each other's trailers, never speak to each other.
And even on the press tours.
They loved each other.
Yes.
They loved each other in the room, but they couldn't communicate. So they wouldn't really, you know, Chris, Jackie calls me every time. Chris calls him, Jay-Chan, I love you. And he calls him, you know, Jackie will not understand.
Which is so crazy because.
By the way, the box set of Rush Hour 1, 2, and 3 is coming out now for Blu-ray, so check that out
too. Hell yeah, because usually the chemistry for people for it to be that great on screen who have never met, usually there is some like hanging out involved, right? So for them to never really kick it and just be amazing when the camera's rolling is
and
phenomenal.
So comedy is a big, I mean, comedy is just, it's the hardest. It's the, you know, comedy act, and when you mix action and comedy, I feel like I took my cue from Eddie, because Eddie was like, always said to me, you know, Brett, you got it, because what you did was Beverly Hills Cop was not a comedy. It was a thriller.
Yeah, it was a thriller and it was an action movie with the funniest man on the planet.
Exactly.
And then
so everybody played it real. Everyone was real and I was just being funny. If you had other comedians in there trying to be funny, you know, everyone was always playing it very real.
Yeah.
And tone-wise, so you have a great villain, which I took the cues off of 48 Hours, you know, and that's even harder than Rush Hour, but Rush Hour is PG-13, right?
Right.
But I always knew, I mean, Eddie was kind of my hero and I studied those movies and I really understood, you know, tone from those movies. Marty Brest was a great director. And I always thought, you know, if I ever get to make a movie in this genre, I know I could do it well because of what Eddie did. Because I understood the difference, because then I'd seen so many of these movies had come out around the time Martin Lawrence had a movie.
Yeah, like Blue Streak or something like that.
Yeah, like all these movies, and they just never got the tone right.
Yeah,
it got goofy,
too goofy, too funny,
too broad, too silly. You didn't. There were not real stakes.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "There's got to be real stakes." So that's why I hired Tom Wilkinson in the first one. I hired Zhang Ziyi, from Crouching Tiger.
Yeah.
I got John Lone from The Last Emperor. I got Alan King, whatever. I got actors that are you know, dramatic. Alan King's he's a comedian, but yeah,
but to play it real.
But play it real. It was always important.
Yeah. And when you're honest, and when you are working with one of your heroes, whether it be Eddie Murphy or whoever, are you ever intimidated on set that you can't, like, give Eddie Murphy a note, or that you can't Alan Alda a note, or any of these guys?
No, I know
it can't be, right?
To be a director, I think you got to have a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You don't always have to be right, but I always have a specific point of view. I know what I want. If I don't know what I want, I'm open. But actors want to be directed.
Yeah.
That's a whole fallacy. Like, oh, if you're a legend, you know what you. But you, they need to. They're only in their scene. They're not thinking about what's coming before or after. Right.
Gotcha.
And it, especially if they're not in every scene in the movie.
Sure.
So they need someone to drive the ship and to kind of decide tone-wise, okay, how fast am I going to go right now? Should I slow it down a little bit? Should I pick up the pace? Where's the beats? Where's the... And so they always... I always love an actor that comes with his own ideas, his own interpretation of how he's going to do it. But there's nothing wrong with, you know, kind of putting your perspective and point of view into it, because you're the director. You got the biggest directors, the best actors I know, the most successful actors I know want to be directed more than the ones that are just cocky fucking, you know,
I know
guys
it all.
Who think they know it all. It's the ones, Anthony Hopkins and, you know, the great at Ray Fiennes and all the great
That was in a
Red Dragon.
My God, I love that film.
Thank you. Thank you.
I didn't even know you did that movie until I was doing research for this interview. And man, because to take on the Hannibal Lecter character, such an iconic character in cinema, and then to do your own interpretation of it. And scary. Had you done a scary film?
It was like the biggest budget student film ever made.
Yeah. the scene where Philip Seymour Hoffman's character goes down the street on fire.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Like that, well, it was so haunting.
You know, the thing is, I think at the end of the day, like I said, it's about taste. So if you have an eye, I think my strength is knowing good material. Right? And then 50 years ago, directors would go from a comedy to a musical to a drama to a Western to a... It was like a assembly line, right? They wouldn't even edit those movies. They would just kind of, but a job as a director, what's their job? They're storytellers. That's their craft. That's their skill set. So I should be able to tell any story, whether it's a comedy, whether it's a scary movie. So I learned on the job, really, because certain things you can and cannot do. And I shot, you know, not all my movies look like Rush Hour.
Right.
So I adjust my storytelling based on the genre and based on what I have to do and how I have to tell that story.
What were some of the biggest differences from Rush Hour to Tower Heist, other than just two people ensemble?
Ensembles are difficult. There was a lot of technical difficulty. I mean, the building in the movie was a character in the building and was a character in the story. And it was very complicated, that movie, with the car and the... I mean, it was just really complex. I mean, it was... You know, you're trying to do a comedy, you're trying to do a heist, you're trying to do an action movie. I love mixing genres. I never have done a straight action movie. I've never done a straight comedy.
Right.
I've always done...
A little bit of both.
Both, because that's the hardest thing to kind of accomplish, because you got to please... You got to be credible in a heist. You know, you have to make a legitimate kind of movie, unless it's a spoof, right?
Sure.
And then you also have to deliver on the humor. But if you're too broad, then you lose the stakes.
Right.
You don't believe Alan Alda then, if you don't. You know what I mean? So you got to... It's a difficult balance.
Now with all the stuff you're doing with Rat Pack Entertainment, how are you choosing projects? Because I imagine you're a guy that people are bringing stuff to.
I'm getting a lot. I mean, look, it's about my own personal taste, my instincts, but also it's about filmmakers that I love. I just did Warren Beatty's new movie. We produced it.
Nice.
And we financed it. And so it's working with people that I love, people I want to work with, young filmmakers, great documentary filmmakers. Yeah. It's just, it's fun. I mean, it's a business, so.
So there's no real, like, set.
No, there's no model. Thing, I mean, we're doing so many movies, it's hard to even. I mean, it's diversification is the business. But it's really about making movies that are high quality and that are, you know, commercial and entertaining and with people that we want to work with and hopefully we make some money too. But that's Rat Pack is the business side.
Yeah.
Documentaries is like the hobby. And directing is my job, basically.
Yeah,
that's my job. So Rat Pack is not a job for me because I love it so much.
Yeah,
yeah.
I get to finance movies. I get to produce movies. I get to write. That's fun, but it's my business.
Yeah.
And documentaries are just like, there's no a lot of money to make in documentaries, but I love it so much.
It's just a passion project.
It's a passion thing. And then directing is just like my career. It's like what I do.
Has there ever been a film that you passed on that then got made that you're like, ah, crap, I should have made that one?
There's two categories. There's films films I passed on that I wasn't all crap, that I felt like most of my films I passed on, and everybody has those stories.
Sure.
That I was happy I passed on. Then there's films that I wish I did that I wasn't even offered.
Oh, yeah.
Why was I offered that film?
Yeah.
You know, I remember I was offered Memoirs of a Geisha at one point, and it was a big, important, you know, I was doing Red Dragon, I was doing
Yeah.
I love Asian culture. I love Asian cinema. I love it. But I just couldn't wrap my head around it. I tried to get into the book, and it was just, it was not moving me. It's like, how do I make it my own? Like, I could do it as a job.
Sure.
But I always wanted to say, how do, and what I love about my movies is that I hope and think an audience is, when you see my movie, you're like, that's a Brett Ratner movie, that you don't have to see my name on it to know it's my movie.
Meaning
you get a sense of, you know, whether it's X-Men or Family Man, I'm in it without being in it.
Right.
My persona is in it.
I was going to say, like, you can tell certain shots are like, all right, that's a Scorsese shot, or that's a
Quentin
Tarantino
shot. But it's
more than
just a shot, because there is, like, Spike Lee has his definitive shot, or Michael Bay even has a, you know.
Yeah, the slow motion rotation.
But it's not the shot. It's more the tone and the energy of the film.
You have a genuine personal connection to everything.
Yeah, every choice is mine. Yeah. Every decision. The actors are taking my cues and direction, and they're there for me and with me, and it's fun.
Was there one moment, I'm just very curious, because how many people get to direct Eddie Murphy, but like, was there one moment that you, in watching or directing or an exchange with you two, where you're just like, holy shit, like I can't believe I got to be in the room for this or be a part of this, just because of how great Eddie is?
Wait, say it again?
Eddie Murphy, like being, I guess, in his presence and just working with him. And
Eddie,
obviously,
Eddie, it's good because Eddie became my friend first.
Yeah.
He saw Rush Hour and called me and was like, I want to meet you. And I was like, this guy's my hero. And just, we became very close friends. I think Eddie at some point thought, I can't ever work with this guy. Brett's too hyper. He's crazy. He's like, you know. But he loved my movie so much. He loved Rush Hour. He loved the other movies I did. He was just really... He
I thought,
was,
you got it.
Yeah, I felt like, fuck. I was so I know he was like hesitant, like, shit, is he gonna drive me crazy? Because Eddie's very particular, I would say, in his, and professional, by the way. Like, there's nobody like him. I mean, he'll look at the page once and know the words, you know. And he's a pro. And I have such, you could tell I have such love for him, and he feels that. He can't. People say, oh, he can be difficult. Eddie's the least difficult person I ever worked with, because he feels my excitement about being on set with him.
It.
Separate than, a lot of times I'll work with the first time director, Mr. Murphy, thank you so much. You know, I'm such an honor to work with you. I don't think he goes for that as much. It's not like ass kissing.
Yeah, it helped that you guys were friends first.
Yeah,
so
I think
there
that
was
helped.
That moment of...
He understood what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
He knew me so well. He got it. He felt it.
How much room is there for him to just kind of other, I mean, just like most things, you'll do one on the page and then go, all right, kind of.
He's happy to do everything on the page, and he's happy to, you know, if you want something, he'll give you something if he finds it. But it's got to happen
organically.
It's the opposite of what, for instance, what Ben Stiller does and a lot of actors do, which is beat the comedy to death and like rehearse it and rehearse it and rehearse it. Eddie just wants to find it.
Yeah. Well, and
it has to come from a real place.
Yeah.
It's not,
and especially with comedy, because if you do it so much, then the material becomes sort of bland to you.
Bland. So
you have to discover
Ben
it.
Ben was like, you know, let's rehearse. And he's like, yeah, man, call me when you're ready. You rehearse the shit, you know. And because he knew it. He knew what he had to do. He knew what he wanted to bring. And Ben, you know, had another, it's another method. It's not, it's just a different way of doing it. I like Eddie's way, really, because Eddie's way is... was more organic, I guess, and not forced.
But
there are, but I do love the I'm a friar, and I'm an abbot of the I'm something in the Friars Club. Maybe I'm an abbot, I don't know.
That's amazing.
But I'm something at the Friars Club. I'm on the board or whatever. But I love the Jewish intellectuals, comedians, where they intellectualize the comedy. You know, it's crazy making. When I work with Mike Myers, I did a music video for Madonna for Austin Powers. I don't know if you remember that, Beautiful Stranger.
Beautiful
remember?
Stranger, right, yeah.
And Mike was...
Well, you did that music video?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's incredible.
And Mike was, Jesus, I mean, he was like genius. I mean, he would only talk to me as Austin Powers. He would not talk to me as Mike Myers.
I mean, that's so the greatest day ever.
It was so frustrating.
Oh,
it was, yeah, baby. He'd be like, you're a big director, baby. Yeah, he'd be like... I'm like, Mike, listen.
So we talked to Mike.
Yeah.
And he did this thing where Madonna was improvising, playing with him. I told her, you know, she was all over him. And he, by the way, so when she did it, he stayed in character because he's a pro.
Right.
But then when he saw it in the film, he was like, you got to get that out. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, that's too far. I'm like, no, it's the funniest thing in the movie.
Yeah.
I don't remember. She was rubbing her vag like on his shoulder. He was like sinking in his chair. But he stayed in character. That was his. I said, but look how in the moment you are. But he came in the edit room and he got, he's like, do you have a pen and a piece of paper? Then he's Mike Myers and he has no sense of humor. He's meaning,
oh, interesting.
Not in a bad way. He was just very serious.
Yeah.
He was just, you know, no joking. I was trying to joke with him. He joked with me the entire fucking shoot. Fucking with me is Austin Powers.
He was Austin Powers, yeah.
And then Mike Myers, I couldn't get a laugh or a joke out of him.
Wow.
So then he says, can I get a pen and a piece of paper? And he says, play the video back. And he would stop and start and stop and start. And he was like, okay. And he's writing like a chart on a piece of paper. And he goes, look at this. ABA, BBC, ABCD, ABD. I'm like, I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
You're like, SOB.
Look at the
what
pattern.
The F, right? Yeah.
Joke, joke. Moment.
Yeah.
Joke, joke. I mean, he was like analyzing and breaking down.
Wow.
Like numerology.
Like Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind. Yeah. Drawings over the place. Yeah.
Like the moments where he was interested, like he was trying to analyze how I came up with it. And I'm just, I'm a gut guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just find the moments, I build them up. He was trying to figure out how intellectually I built this music video with so much humor. And built up to the climax. And then, because what I did was, most music videos, you know, you shoot four different locations or four different set pieces, and then you intercut them.
Mm-hmm.
And but then you're bored at the end of 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I held things. I don't remember, there was like a colorful set where there was, you know, it was spins.
I remember there was a green, sort of a green background.
Yeah, no, green background, but also the floor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I drew like a, whatever, it was like a spin top, you know, whatever. So I held that, or even Mini Me.
Mm-hmm.
I shot him for hours there with all these hot chicks all over him.
Sure, he didn't mind that.
I used him for literally 2 seconds in the video. But it was such a big
necessary
moment.
Yeah.
Because if I learned, because when I did my films at NYU Film School, I had this incredible shot and I used it 27 times in the movie and it was boring after the third time. So I realized less if you show more. Something once,
yeah,
it's so much more powerful.
Yeah.
So I had the best footage of Mini-Me dancing with these hot chicks, but I only used it for 2 seconds and I got one of the biggest laughs.
There you go.
In the movie. But it was just something that I just knew from my experience, from my, you know.
Mm-hmm. You feel like you take something from every project, everything.
Every fucking project, I learn something, whatever it is. Yeah. I just learned something. I learned from the mistakes and from successes. But he was saying, back to just how Mike, you know, he was trying to intellectualize it and analyze how I did it. And I'm like, there's no way to analyze this. This is just my understanding of comedy and of what makes fun and what's funny. And I wasn't having like test audiences come in to see it. I was like, oh, that's funny. That's funny. Put it in.
So that's how he operates though, huh? Just really, I mean,
yeah, he has a different way. Like again, there's a lot of the old Jewish comedians do that. They kind of overthink and, you know, I'm sure. You know.
Yeah. They break it down.
Yeah.
I wanted to, before we wrap this up, when we met at the Beverly Hills Hotel. You sat down and had breakfast next to me and my girlfriend, who is now my fiance, by the way.
Oh, congrats.
Thank you, sir. And then you told me that you were in the whiskey business.
Yes.
And I was like, what? Brett Ratner's in the whiskey business? And you sent me a bottle.
Yeah.
I went through it amazingly fast.
Okay, yeah.
So it's great. It's called the Hill Haven Lodge.
Named after the house that we're sitting in right now.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
And it is damn good whiskey, sir.
Yeah. I never dreamed I'd be in the whiskey business.
Because you never had to drink in your life.
Yeah. But I never, I more than that, it was just that I always, you know, spirits and cocktails and were always just like part of cool culture.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, okay, you know, at the time, this was like 9 years ago, Mad Men was a phenomenon and everything from the 50s and 60s was coming back, and you know, every time there was a cool moment, he grabs a glass of whiskey, and I was like, the 50s has got to come back. So I met with this company, Diageo, and they were like, you know, it's all about tequila and vodka. I'm like, no, that's everywhere. I said, whiskey is cool. They go, no, it's not doing any business, whiskey. And I said, no, you don't understand. I think whiskey's, you know, Sinatra, Jack Nichol. I mean, everybody cool I know drinks whiskey.
Sinatra's buried with a bottle of Jack Daniels.
Right.
Yeah. So
and I'm
whiskey's
like,
cool, my
yeah, and I'm like, you know, it's gotta come back at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few years, they said, wow, you know what, Brett, you were right. We're tracking, you know, whiskey globally, and it's really starting to make a move. And then I said, well, let's do it. This house is very famous from the 20s. Parties. It was built just for parties.
No kidding.
It was the party house to a big estate. It was just for parties, entertaining.
Wow.
And so I said, this house has had decades of parties. And I continue the tradition. There's a disco in the basement that was built in the 70s. The
what?
Guy bought it. Alan Carr produced Grease. Built a disco in the 70s. I'll give you guys a tour.
Yes. Hell yes.
And I said, you know, this house needs a house whiskey. A house spirit. And it should be whiskey. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what they drank at the heyday of this house when there was parties here. And so we worked on it. And Diageo is the best in the world at selling spirits and creating, you know, brands. Believed in me, believed in the concept, and created a blend that no one has ever done before, which is a whiskey, a rye, and a bourbon mixed together.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
I said, but here's the key. If you can make it, I watched Patron. Before Patron, women were not drinking tequila. There was a worm in it. It would burn.
Yeah.
It would. I said, if you guys can make something smooth enough that women can sip this without having to put Coke in it, without having to mixer and just without even an ice cube, we're going to win. And that's what they did. And that's how we have the Hellhaven Lodge.
Yep.
And so it is, I mean, Brad, you're not, I'm not paying you to say this.
Nope.
Right?
It's damn good.
People love it. I mean, people who are whiskey aficionados.
Yeah.
Aaron Paul is like, this is my favorite whiskey I've ever tasted.
Holy
shit. I mean, literally, I mean, people who know whiskey, know the drink, who are only Johnny Walker drinkers for 30 years are switching to Hellhaven.
Yeah.
It's called the Hellhaven Lodge. And it's right now it's in California and Florida. It's coming out this year, 2017, New York, Nevada. It's in Kentucky, too, because that's where we make it. We have a distillery there.
Oh, nice. Has to be.
And so we have it in Kentucky. We're opening in New York, you know, because each state you have to license. And it's a whole complicated thing. Mm-hmm. So New York, Nevada, and it's coming out, I think, Texas. So we roll it out. But it'll be global. It'll be everywhere in the world. And we're just very selective places. You know, they serve it at the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Yep.
It's by the pool. They have a mixed drink by the pool.
That's amazing.
You know, Bel Air Hotel. You know, they sell it at Wally's. They sell it at the usual places, the Chateau Marmont and all the cool spots.
So find this bottle of whiskey and enjoy it while watching the new box set of Rush Hour.
Exactly.
So, yeah, buy the box set on Blu-ray. Exactly. Enjoy your Hellhaven Lodge.
I do want to know real quick before we wrap up. Brett, you said you have a lot of parties here and whatnot, and people stay here. Brett said at one point, and maybe this is true or not true, Michael Jackson was staying here?
Michael Jackson stayed with me, yeah. Michael Jackson and I would live together for months at a time. I would go stay at Neverland. He would come here and stay here.
Wow.
And we would go to Florida, where my family's house. We would live there for months at a time. Michael was my best friend. Michael was one of the greatest, unbelievable people ever. I mean, I remember I had no furniture in the house, and I'm sitting on my bed with my friend from Hong Kong, this guy, and we're sitting there watching, you know, movie, whatever, and the gate rings, and I open it. I didn't check. I didn't have, like, the security cameras and stuff. Mm-hmm. And in walks Michael Jackson in full sequence military regalia. You know, with like tuxedo pants and the white socks and the black shoes.
And you're saying, what weird NyQuil dream am I on
right
now?
And my friend was like completely freaked out.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson was sitting there and he comes and sits on the bed with us for hours. And just sits on the bed and went
shoots the shit?
Yeah. Huh?
And just shoots the shit.
Yeah, and just hung out. And then, I mean, he was amazing. He was...
Funny guy?
Hysterical, but practical jokes. He would do shit. I mean, I would get in trouble every time I tell the story, but it was like other things he would do, which was just... childish, obviously, because he was a kid, but he would always get a room sometimes at the Beverly Wilshire, and I'd be in the room, and he'd ask me to go fill up some balloons with water. I go, why? He goes, I just want to fill up the balloons with water. And then he'd go out on the balcony and start throwing him at people on the street, and he hit this woman in the head with a balloon, so it didn't hurt, but she had just come from the beauty parlor. Her hair was like fully, and she went in the management, and the manager, they start banging on the door, and Michael goes, I'm gonna go hide under the bed. So the manager comes, and I go, hi, how are you? He goes, Mr. Ratner, can you please ask Mr. Jackson? I go, Mr. Jackson's not here. Can you tell me to tell him that he's we know he's in here in the building.
Who are those sequin shoes under the bed that are sticking out?
Please ask him to stop throwing water balloons, please, at the people up down below.
By the way, what a great sentence. Please tell Michael Jackson to stop throwing water balloons. Yeah.
I mean,
unbelievable.
He would do shit like that. And his house was just unbelievable. I mean, he had a theater the size of Lowe's on his property.
No shit.
With these king-size beds that were in the back of the theater, but inside this pane window. like, you know, and they would just imagine a giant bed that you kind of, it was like,
yeah,
they were like these hospital beds,
like a recliner bed, recliner, yeah,
beds.
And you got to see him live and or work in the studio. I mean, did you get to
I mean, you know, he was doing a video with Paul Hunter, a friend of mine.
Remember the time?
No, not remember the time though. I forgot the name of it, but Chris Tucker was in it.
Yeah. Oh,
And he wouldn't show up for 3 days because he said, I thought Brett was directing this. I go, Michael, I'm not directing. He goes, I'm not coming unless Brett's there. It was like, I felt bad for the poor director.
Yeah.
He was my friend. And he was like, I had to go down there and go in this trailer. He would not come out for 3 days. Literally, would not come out. It was costing like $1 million a day. Brando was there. In the video.
Oh, remember that? Rock This World or something?
Chris Tucker was dancing.
Yeah,
like, I'm there. No, kind
you
of
did it.
Yeah,
that behind one. The camera, like going like this. God, I got to find those pictures.
That's unbelievable. You are a man that turned no's into yeses.
Yeah, no
and
shit.
That is a distinct talent. And all this that is around us right now, you've definitely earned. And whether it be whiskey, whether it be movies, whether it be throwing water balloons at people with Michael Jackson.
You've done it all.
Done it all, my friend.
All right, man. So, well, great for thanks for having
dude,
me.
Dude, this is unbelievable.
I'll come check out your set.
You have to, yeah.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Thank you so much,
Brad. All right, Brad.
Thanks, bud.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamay Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.
Hey guys, it's me, Owen Benjamin, and I'm here to tell you about my podcast. It's called Why Didn't They Laugh? Right here on Sideshow Network. Each episode, we look at moments that a joke fails. Moments that we don't want to relive, but we will, because we learn from it, and it's kind of fun, and we're all kind of sadistic. Why Didn't They Laugh? With me, Owen Benjamin, every Wednesday and Friday. You can download it, be sure to rate it, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or check us out on SideshowNetwork.tv/OwenBenjamin. I love you.